Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people's stories and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for the next hour, Saquon Gatlin, and I want to personally thank you for joining us for this June 11th edition of the show. A descendant of a war veteran has led his family in researching its history. Mike Booth and nearly 30 members united at the Ames Municipal Cemetery to witness the site where his great-grandfather was honored as a Civil War veteran in the 1930s. He began exploring his genealogy after hearing a story about the veteran C.E. Graves in a family reunion 4 years ago. Since 2014, Booth has traveled around the country and overseas researching his family's history. After hearing about his great-grandfather, he discovered the veteran moved from Maine to Iowa after the war. Family members traveled from Missouri, Minnesota, and even Arizona to the Ames Municipal Cemetery on Saturday to honor the site where C.E. Graves was previously honored. Booth's mother, Connie, has explored other sites where her grandfather's extended family resides. Mike plans to visit other places where the Graves landed in the 13 colonies. An Ames pastor is retiring after more than a decade and a half of service to the community. Reverend Fred Lewis is retiring from his lead pastor position at the Ames United Methodist Church. His ministry involves spans over four decades, starting during his sophomore year of college at Morningside College in Sioux City. After moving to Ohio, he considered becoming the lead pastor of the Methodist Theological School. Lewis moved back to Iowa after receiving his Master's of Divinity and began practicing as an associate pastor in Ankeny. He became the lead pastor of UMC in Jansville, then transferred to UMC in Ames in 2002. Although he plans to retire from his leadership role, Lewis anticipates continuing his service to the Ames community. His retirement party will be held this Sunday, June the 17th, at the Ames United Methodist Church. The Iowa Board of Regents recently voted to raise tuition rates for the three major state universities. The board unanimously voted to increase Iowa State's in-state tuition rate by 3.8% and out-of-state tuition by 4%. This ruling raised resident undergraduate tuition by $284 per year and non-resident tuition by $852 per year. Students will also see an increase in fees depending on their college and residential status. International students will receive an additional $542 increase on top of the raised tuition rates. President Wendy Winterstein issued an official email informing students of the tuition increases on Thursday, encouraging students to check the Office of Student Financial Aid website to find more information about scholarships, opportunities, and application deadlines. A Ames man who initially pled guilty to a sexual assault is now looking to overturn the ruling. 34-year-old Clarence Casto pleaded guilty in early April to assault with intent to commit sexual abuse. The assault occurred in October of 2016. The victim, who remains nameless, contacted the Ames police on October 14th of 2016, stating she was sexually assaulted by Casto. He was arrested in August of 2017 and charged with third-degree sexual assault and assault with the intent to commit sexual abuse. Castell said he would not have pled guilty if his lawyer had advised him of the sexual assault registry requirements. His attorney, Brian Barker, has filed a motion to overturn Castell's case. The hearing for the motion occurs on July the 2nd. The National Weather Service issues a flash flood warning over central Iowa until 8 a.m. Thunderstorms persisted throughout the night last night and will continue this morning. There's a chance of scattered thunderstorms in the afternoon, some of which may be severe. Heavy rain is scheduled over the course of the day with a 90% chance of precipitation. Expect a midday high of 82 degrees and a low of 65 tonight. Be sure to check weather announcements as the flash flood watch may continue. Tomorrow the storms will calm down, but the sun won't be out just yet. Tuesday is partly cloudy with a high of 83 going into the afternoon and a low of 64 degrees. On Wednesday, we will have a lower chance of the rain, and the sun will start to come out a little bit more, as the high will be 85 and the low will be about 65 as well. On Thursday, we shall see more of the same. And as we approach the weekend, the temperatures break back into the 90s with lower chance of rain and thunderstorms. On Sunday, you can expect more of those thunderstorms to come about in the afternoon. Ames is known for the beauty of Iowa State University and its historically downtown area. Politicians pride themselves on low unemployment rates, and residents understand the community dynamic knitting us together. However, there is an issue in the shadows, hidden in the alleyways and out of sight: homelessness. For many of us, seeing homeless people around our city can be rare or few and far apart. Yet homelessness impacts every community, including ours. Hope Matheny works with homeless youth at YSS as the Transitional Living and Lighthouse Program Coordinator for Boone and Story Counties. We sat down and spoke about what the homelessness means to Ames and how homelessness affects youth in our community.
Being homeless would be not having a safe or adequate home to sleep in at night, maybe living in a place not meant for rehabilitation, or fleeing domestic violence.
I understand there's like different definitions for different places. How does that change for different places?
So we use the official HUD definition of homelessness that's provided to us because we have HUD funding. Places like at the school gets to use a McKinney-Vento Act definition of homelessness. And what that means, at the schools, they get to count being doubled up as being homeless. While our standards, we do not get to count that.
And can you explain what doubled up is?
That would be like two families living in the same apartment.
Okay. I understand there may be a correlation between foster care and homelessness. Can you explain that to our audience?
Sure. So my program focuses on youth homelessness. And one of the big issues that I see, or we see in our program, are the youth aging out of foster care. So the day they turn 18, they don't have anywhere to go to as they're aging out of placement or foster care. And so about 58%, I would say, of my homeless youth who are 18 are actually aging out of the system. And so the day they turn 18, they're homeless.
Oh, wow. And so this has happened to plenty of the youth at YSS?
Yes. We do have different programs to help with these kind of things with youth so that no youth is lost without anywhere to go in the system. They have an aftercare advocate, which helps with that transition from childhood to being an adult, then follows them from the age of 18 through 21 of these youth aging out of foster care. A lot of times we get referrals about a month ahead of time too, that the birthdays of these young youth are coming up, so we can try to start making planning for them so they don't have to spend even one night on the street.
Okay. All right. And then what would you say are other causes of homelessness for youth in Ames?
In Ames, or in Iowa, I deal with both Boone and Story County, but we accept from basically anywhere. Here, a lot of my youth don't have parents like typically you or I might have had growing up. And so maybe one of their parents is in jail or prison, or they're dealing with their own mental health issues, so they can't really provide for their youth in the way that we would expect. And so maybe they're facing their own eviction. And so with that, the youth is getting evicted as well. And the parents are like, you're 18 now, or getting kicked out of college, being homeless, losing their housing, being evicted, all kinds of things, I think.
Okay. You had an interesting story about a young homeless mother. Can you share that with us?
Yes. So What this is back in March, we have an event called Reggie Sleep Out, and it's to bring awareness to homelessness here in Ames, specifically around youth homelessness. And Reggie was a youth that aged out of the system, and then within 3 months, he was found dead in the Des Moines River. So we try to raise awareness and funds so that this doesn't happen to other people. So we made my Transitional Living and Lighthouse programs. We made a structure to take to Reggie's Sleep Out, and we decided for our structure, we were going to put clients' stories on it so they could share why they were homeless while it was still confidential. So we were just going to hang them up on our structure, our little house that we made, and take it to Jack Trice Stadium that day. And this is the story of one of my clients that she wrote to hang up on the structure. She said, "I have a 3-year-old son. 2 years ago, we were kicked out on the streets. We slept in the tunnels at parks at winter. I had to get our meals out of dumpsters. My son was removed because no one wanted to help the nasty homeless girl. I was stalked, harassed, and beaten. Because of the Lighthouse program, I'm on my way to getting my son back. Thank you for giving me a home and saving my life."
Wow. And have you heard more from her in recent times? Or?
I just heard from her this week. She's okay. Still with us and still working the program. To become self-sufficient, it doesn't happen overnight. It can take a while. So the young moms or pregnant or parenting people, it doesn't necessarily have to be a mother. It could be a father, too, can have up to 2 years in the program. And this is used to help them get a job, maintain a job, getting a living wage job, getting high school, finishing high school, trying to get a trade school or something that could give them a better than minimum wage job so we can get them out of the system, hopefully prevent long-term chronic homelessness, and give her the skills that she needs to move on. So she's still currently with us working on all the things she needs to.
Okay. And why may ending homelessness be more difficult for young parents compared to just youth in general?
Yes. So our young parents face many struggles that a young single person doesn't. And a lot of that has to do with the shifts that they could work. If it's a single person, they could work any shift, where if it's a single parenting person, they're really limited to what daytime or daycare hours are here in the community. And most of our daycares around here are only daytime, so our parents are limited then to daytime shifts. And they have to have openings. A lot of our daycares here have a wait list, and so everything has to line up just perfectly. They can only accept certain jobs during certain hours. Most of my youth don't have transportation, so then they take a bus, an hour to get to daycare and to work, and then an hour to get home from work and pick up their children every night. So it just makes it for a lot longer day and a lot more responsibilities when you're taking care of a family as compared to just yourself.
Interesting. That's understandable. I feel like it would be more difficult, especially if you have more children. How many children on average would you say may a homeless parent or youth parent have?
So the last time I ran the report for our Ames community, our pregnant and parenting people had on average 2.2 children.
Okay.
So multiple children per household. And then you can just see how everything starts to add up to with more children. There's more responsibilities, more laundry. You need to cook balanced meals every day, where the single person that's college age typically doesn't think about balanced meals as much. They're okay with I made a frozen pizza, where as a parent, you need to really think about all the food groups that we're talking to them about and everything, too.
Okay, that's very understandable. How does YSS find homeless youth, or do they find you? How does that work out?
They find us. a lot of it is through word of mouth, really. A youth comes in, they know the program, and so they tell their friends about it, or they refer their friends, like, I know this program that can help you. It's helping me. So that people like DHS workers, JCS, the schools, we've been lucky to be around the community for a long time, so we have a lot of networking between emergency shelters and every place. They know if there's a homeless youth, if they get connected to us, we can help them out.
All right. And I understand there's a difference between homeless children and unaccompanied youth. What does that actually mean?
So an unaccompanied youth would be a minor, so 17 or younger, that does not have a legal guardian or parent with them. A homeless youth would be a youth, so a minor, that is still with their parents, but they're still homeless.
Okay, and do you know about how many of each situation there may be, or just homeless children and youth in Ames in general, or in this county? Do you know about how much that would be?
So we did a point in time count at the last Wednesday in January, and that's where we try to collect information for all of our sheltered, transitional living, and unsheltered homeless people here in the county. I believe our numbers for everybody that day was around 100. They did find people on the street that they are unsheltered that last day in January, so it was pretty cold. The report I had, so just YSS would have had 17 youth here in Ames that would have been homeless if not provided in or have housing and transitional living on that night. So, significant amount.
Where do homeless children sleep? Where do they actually find shelter at? Or
so once they find shelter or prior?
Prior. So, okay. What are the situations before they get to maybe YSS or the shelter services or so?
So that can vary from individual to individual. We already talked about foster care youth. So foster care youth might be aging out of a place like Bremwood, Orchard Place. So the night before entry, they would have been in whatever placement they were in foster care, whether it be with a parent or a facility, like I mentioned. Other youth are a lot of times couch hopping, so staying from place to place to place every night. Just last week, I went and I picked up a youth to bring into the program, and so when I picked her up, we ended up stopping at 4 different places just so we could pick up her clothes, because they were scattered everywhere of just random places she was staying because she was homeless. So there's a lot of that. Over the past 2 weeks, I've had a youth report that they were actually sleeping on a park bench. A youth slept in a garage. Some come from emergency shelter, so they know they've went to the emergency shelter and the like ERP tells them, contact YSS. They have a program specifically for youth. And then they come directly from emergency shelter. Okay. So kind of everything.
So it can just be
a
wide variety of situations going on. Can you explain what the mental impact is on a homeless child?
So, as we can imagine, being homeless is really traumatic. And different people deal with that in different ways. Not having a safe place to sleep at night, not having, knowing where you're going to get your next meal really affects a person, whether it's with their schoolwork or going to work. It can be very intimidating to not know where you're going to sleep or sleep in a car and then still try to get ready for school the next day and act like everything is okay. It's said about 80% of our youth have a co-occurring issue. And what that means for a co-occurring issue would be a mental health or a substance abuse issue. So as you can imagine, a lot of youth might turn to drugs or alcohol to deal with their trauma as a coping skill. So not only are we dealing with homelessness, we're dealing with youth who perhaps are unmedicated for their mental health, because if you don't know where you're going to sleep, it's really hard to remember to go get refills of your medications and make it to doctor's appointments. And then they may be coping by using substances.
Wow. Wow. It's very hard to take in some of the information that's being shared, because I believe it is kind of hidden in a way from the public or so. Like, I've been in Ames for maybe 5 years now, and I haven't really experienced any of this before. You know, you go to the university. I'm a college student here. So if you go to the university, you have this very nice university. There are very beautiful places in Ames, but you don't really see it. That's not in the forefront. You don't really see it. So it's almost hidden within the shadows. How do we know more about this?
That's why we have awareness events, to try to bring this to the forefront of people's minds, too. And it can really depend on the season here, is what homelessness looks like. Because when it's 20 below zero, you might not see people really sleeping on a park bench because they're going to freeze. Now with the weather rising, they could get heat exhaustion or heat stroke as well. It is hidden here, and a lot of our youth are really, they're really mobile. They really house hop from place to place, and they're really good about being in a crisis mode and using their resources, staying with friend to friend to friend, so they don't wear out a resource. And so that's why we have events like Reggie's Sleep Out to bring awareness to our community. And then in November, too, it's National Hunger and Homeless Awareness Week. And we also always do an event during that time to try to bring awareness during different seasons as well. Because here in Iowa, with all of our seasons, homelessness can look a little bit different every season. Last year, with the city of Ames sponsoring, we did a Scoop of Soup event where people could come out and get a scoop of soup and learn information about hunger and homelessness, because a lot of times they go hand in hand. So a lot of it's just raising awareness here, and then knowing who to contact if you do see it, homelessness, or if you know someone, so you can give the resources to the person or help them make that connection. Maybe they don't know to call me, but if you know that, then you can be like, I've met Hope at YSS. She works with homeless youth. She can help you, and kind of give that referral on. They're more likely to call and get assistance if it's a warm referral instead of them just Googling it.
We talked a little bit about the mental implications or the impacts on homelessness. Can you detail some of the physical dangers that someone may face while being homeless or actually out on the street?
A lot of it could be weather related. Of course, if they're actually sleeping on the street, you could have well, now heat stroke, heat exhaustion, that kind of stuff. In the winter time, it could be frostbite or hypothermia, those kind of things. A lot of it is just, I've had a youth come in who didn't have shoes before. So we were lucky enough to be able just to provide that youth with a pair of shoes. We partner with Overflow Thrift Store here in Ames, which is only about a block away from where my office is located, and we can write vouchers to help get youth the appropriate clothing they need. So in this weather, maybe it's them going over there and getting a pair of shorts so they're not wearing still their winter jacket, because if you're homeless, you're taking all of that with you. And so it could be people just maybe not weather appropriate because they don't have the things.
Can you explain, there's an interesting statistic about what happens to most youth within, or most homeless people within a certain time frame. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So the statistics by, one of our runaway and homeless youth grants says that 40% of youth who are runaway and homeless youth will be abused in the first 48 hours of running away or becoming homeless. And so what that means is abuse could be, they could be mugged, they could be stolen into human trafficking, they could be kidnapped, they could just be beat up, or a wide variety of things. But these are really vulnerable young people out on the street going through a crisis of being runaway or homeless, and it really makes them more at risk of being taken advantage of by adults during that time.
Wow. The housing situation, you said you had the Lighthouse project or so. Can you explain that just a little bit more for us?
Sure. The Lighthouse program is for pregnant or parenting people age 17 through 24, and then they have up to 24 months in a house or apartment to work on the skills that they need to become self-sufficient. And so, like I said, some of those skills could look a little bit different as a parenting person, like establishing daycare, getting a job, or doing high school work during more specific hours or online classes. And so we make it individualized for parenting people. And then transitional living, that's our single people program. And so that's for single people age 17 through 21. And they can stay up to 21 months to really work on those skills that are individualized to them, which could be a little bit different than parents. So each youth is, regardless of what program they're in, they each get their own case plan, and we're updating that at least quarterly to work on sets of goals with them of what they see their successful future looking like. And then we measure how they're doing towards reaching those goals, like whether it be saving money to get their own house or their own apartment, car, whatever, graduating high school, getting a job, all kinds of different things. And we're talking about that every week to see what we can do to assist them to reach their goals. And then just being kind and decent to all of our individuals, giving them, we give every client who comes in a hygiene packet, you know, with toothpaste, shampoo, conditioner, body wash in it. Because a lot of times if you're homeless, you might not have been able to take those things with you. And it's really, it can be really degrading to have to ask for something as simple as deodorant. So instead of degrading, saying, do you need this too? We try to really empower our youth to just offer them all of these things, not make them feel bad, just have it be a program expectation. Everybody gets this when they come in. If you don't use it, you're always welcome to turn it back in. When you get on your feet better, let's try to do community activities together so you can pay it forward and really just empower our youth and make them part of the community so they really feel like they fit in and they're not an outcast.
Do you have any college preparation at all in the program for them?
It depends on each youth. I just had, this month has been a busy month, so between my two sites that I run in Ames and Boone, I've just had 5 youth graduate high school. Hooray! And so that's been pretty exciting. And so their caseworkers help them do things like fill out the FAFSA and make sure if they want to go to DMAC, help them sign up for their COMPASS testing or ACTs and do all of that more one-on-one with the youth, or connect them to people who can help them whether it be setting up a time to meet with an advisor or taking a tour at a college with them or talking about those things. But that's real individualized too.
How can the community contribute to in homelessness?
Sure. So some of it's awareness. Of course, anybody can always come to our events like Ready Sleep Out. We do accept donations. My program is always looking for donations, monetary ones, so we can get them what they need. I also, in just Ames alone, run 6 different sites for these homeless youth. And so we're always looking for donations of like towels, pillows, new bedding, to really make the youth feel at home and all of those things. It takes a lot of time and effort to run 6 sites just here in our community and making sure the youth have everything they need, like a bed to sleep in at night. So awareness and, of course, through donations are always welcome.
Awesome, awesome. Is there anything else you would like to share with us about either YSS or homelessness in general?
There's always so much to share.
There's a lot to share.
I know YSS has been around here a long time, helping a lot of youth in the community. And so I feel very fortunate to be able to be a part of that and just to be continuing to be able to help youth out and get the word out too that there are homeless youth and we have the power to make a difference and give these youth a home and make them part of a successful future, that these youth should be really given the opportunity to succeed. And that's what we're here for. So we always are looking for support through our message of empowering our youth.
Awesome, awesome. And that was Hope Matheny with YSS, Youth and Shelter Services, providing us with some interesting information about the homeless youth in our area. We want to make sure that our listeners are aware of what is going on in our community in ways that they can help out. How can they connect with you and your program if they wanted to help out or donate?
Sure. So they could get a hold of me personally at my email, and that's H Matheny, and Matheny is M-E-T-H-E. E-N-Y at YSS.org, or they can always call the YSS office and ask to be directed to my extension. And our phone number is 515-233-2250. And again, my name is Hope Matheny.
Contact information will be available on our website later on this afternoon at khoifm.org. Do you ever think about how much waste we produce? Welcome to Points to Ponder, this edition written by Colin Berzek. Americans throw away 500 million straws every day. Now let's do some math. That's more than 180 billion straws a year, roughly 1.4 million kilograms of plastic sent to dumps and oceans. A study conducted by a group called Last Plastic Straw showed that 80 to 90% of all marine debris is plastic. Of all of the waste being poured into our oceans, research shows that the estimated 8 million tons of plastic found come from the land. Being careless is beginning to take its toll. The environment is crying out for help, but only few listen. The United Nations launched a campaign in the winter of 2017 to help address the fight against marine litter. The goal is to target the production and consumption of single-use and non-compostable plastic. A global partnership has already formed with 30 different countries, including the United Kingdom, Canada, France, Indonesia, Sierra Leone, Brazil, Norway, Italy, Costa Rica, Kenya, and Peru. The holdouts are China, Russia, Japan, and the United States. However, certain states are becoming activists towards the movement. Lawmakers in Florida, Washington, and California have passed ordinances limiting or prohibiting the use of plastic straws or other utensils that are not compostable. Seattle is going as far as completely banning the commercial use of all plastic utensils. Starting July 1st, any and all restaurants in the Seattle area will need to provide its customers with compostable replacements. There are several things we can do to help reduce waste. Almost all major grocery stores and retail stores sell reusable shopping bags for affordable prices. Just one plastic bag can take up to 1,000 years to degrade. When purchasing laundry detergent, some brands offer their products in cardboard boxes. Cardboard is much simpler to recycle than a plastic bottle. You can use matches instead of a plastic lighter, using a razor with replaceable blades instead of using disposables. Packing lunch or dinner in reusable containers. Hy-Vee and Walmart have canned plastic and glass redemption centers where you can earn a small sum of money for recycling certain containers. These are all very simple alternatives to the way we are accustomed to doing things. The next time you're visiting an ocean, national park, or any other place of nature, take a moment to fully embrace the environment. We often take the beauty of our outdoors for granted, and it's showing. Thousands of animals are dying throughout the seas from ingesting plastic. If this doesn't open your eyes, think of it this way. It's affecting the food chain. It's disrupting agriculture on our states and countries along the coast, and we the people do consume lots of seafood. Of course, reducing the use of plastic won't save the world or clean the oceans. It's all about raising awareness that'll gradually lead to societal changes. If you decline straws for drinks at restaurants or bars, use a tumbler at your local coffee shop, or use reusable grocery bags, it will get people talking. Do you believe any of these tasks would be easy to incorporate in your daily life? Do you think this is asking too much? You have been listening to Points to Ponder, this week's edition, written by Colin Berzek. What's your perspective? I am here with Keith Morgan, the Emergency Management Coordinator of Story County Emergency Management, and he joins me in the studio with a couple people for his regularly scheduled broadcast. Welcome to the program, Keith, and it's a pleasure meeting you for the first time.
Morning, Quan. Thank you very much. We've got a couple of people here. We're going to kind of revisit a topic that we've talked to before, which is volunteerism, sheltering. All of these things come together to make it so that our communities are safer and that we have the capability to respond to any disasters that might be happening. Folks might remember that we had a 70-car pileup out on I-35. What they may not be aware of is we've also had apartment buildings that have burned, 70-unit apartment buildings. And just north of us, they've had to do some evacuations of apartment buildings up in Sarasota County. All of those have one thing in common. We've got to find quickly a way to take these people out of this dangerous environment and get them sheltered. So that was the basis of a project that I handed off to our Coalition for Disaster Recovery Coordinator, and our Coalition for Disaster Recovery is an umbrella organization that brings together lots of volunteer organizations to meet needs during disasters. And Betty Bocella, who is here, was our coordinator that was given the project of figuring out how we can rapidly take care of people in sheltering. And she's got a guest here, and she's going to talk to how she put it together so that we have some rats to be capable of taking care of those that need help immediately.
Thank you for joining us on the program, Betty. Can you please introduce yourself and who your guest is?
Thank you, Quan. Yes, I'm happy to be here. And in a moment, I will tell you exactly who the rats are, sort of an alarming term until you understand what that means. And with us this morning is Mike Whitney from Huxley, and he is a trained rat. So we'll be visiting about an exercise we had just this past Saturday. So when Keith talked to me about this program and the idea of needing a response quickly, as he suggested, after a car pileup on the interstate, apartment fire, those kinds of things, we need to be able to have a place for people who have been affected to go, like within 30 to 45 minutes. So I came up with this idea of rapid action team for shelters, thus rats. So my project, one of the projects I've worked on this past year as coordinator for the coalition, is recruiting and training teams of local people in communities across the county to open a shelter and begin to intake people into that shelter until the American Red Cross arrives. So I received my training from the American Red Cross on how to open a shelter and set it up, and pass that training on to local folks here in Story County. So we have teams right now in Ames, Huxley, Nevada, Story City, and I'm working on one on the eastern side of Story County, and we have a good contact there. So what we did was approach facilities, primarily churches, that have previously been designated as American Red Cross shelters. Began talking with the folks there, and from that grew about 31 people now across the county that have been trained as rats, and Mike's one of those folks. So they go through an initial training and then an exercise or a practice to put their skills into use, learn how to set up the cots, how to put up the signage, how to welcome people, how to begin some of the documentation, the paperwork. And we had an exercise a year ago that was very successful. And the reason for exercises is to learn where the gaps are and where the weaknesses are and how to improve those things. So we went through that again this past Saturday and still kind of sifting through how that went. So we feel very proud about this project in Story County, and it's the first in the state, and hoping that as we work through some of the bugs with it, that it'll be a program that can be replicated in other parts of the state is our hope. So we thought it'd be fun to hear from Mike, a person who's been trained and through an exercise now, and he can tell you where he's from and what facility is used in Huxley. And Mike, just tell us a little bit about what you experienced in the exercise on Saturday as well.
Yeah, my name is Mike Whitney, and I attend Grace E. Free Church, and that's our shelter in Huxley. Coming into the exercise Saturday, I didn't have a lot of preconceived notions about what it was going to be. I didn't think it would be that difficult. But once we started, I realized that there is a lot of aspects to it. You know, like Betty said, you know, we go in, we set up, put up signs, set up cots. You know, I thought, okay, this is going to be easy. But the real learning part for me during the exercise was when they had actors come in that were exhibiting different signs of different ailments, being mental disorders or things like that. Just dealing with that kind of a situation is difficult. You know, if you've been displaced, you're homeless. Like the exercise we did focused on a tornado, so a lot of people's houses had been completely destroyed. Just coming into that alone would be difficult, but if you're struggling to begin with, it is even more difficult. And dealing with those kind of people, being able to empathize with what they're going through is not as easy as it sounds. So the training for me was really good to just kind of get in that mindset of these people, you know, potentially have lost everything and have no idea the shock of everything weighs on them also. So dealing with that kind of a situation is tough, and being able to empathize and get information from people that may be in shock.
I think that's something that is so important for people to understand with our RAT teams, is that you can figure out how to set up a cot and where people should sleep and where they should eat and that sort of thing. But really tending to those emotional needs of folks when they come to the shelter, and that's what Mike's addressing. And we did stump them a little bit on Saturday with some actors that came in with a woman who had a dog that didn't want to let it go. It couldn't come into the shelter. Well, how do you handle that? Someone that came in with a mental health issue. Okay, how do we handle that? So it really causes them to have to think and problem solve on the spot, because you never know in real time shelter who might come through the doors.
So do you give them time to prepare for these situations, or how does that necessarily work? Like, are they just randomly put into these situations, or what is the preparation for, like, it could be, like you said, this mental illness case or the woman with the dog? How do you prepare them before that, or are they put in these situations on the spot?
That's a good question, Quan, and it's minimal preparation, in all honesty. In the initial training that the teams have, we talk about, just in general terms, what they might be confronted with in a shelter and some helpful hints on how to work through that. They only got a 24-hour notice of what this – they knew the exercise was coming, but they only got a 24-hour notice through email that it was going to be a tornado, how many people were displaced, et cetera. But it wasn't until the actual exercise then where the actors come and they're briefed on who they're supposed to portray, mm-hmm. and it's really thinking on your feet.
I think that's pretty incredible that you do that, because – it would put someone in a real life situation, because you don't necessarily know who might walk through those doors and what their experience is.
It really shows why we need trained volunteers before a disaster. We always have a lot of people, this is Iowa, that show up after the disaster has occurred, and they want to help. But we really need folks that have got a basis of knowledge. And that's what the Coalition for Disaster is all about. It's to try and get volunteer organizations. We're thrilled that within communities, these organizations are picking up different tasks that might be needed within their community during a disaster. And now Huxley, as opposed to us having to wait maybe upwards of 4 hours for the Red Cross to get there, they're now ready to go within 30 minutes. And even if it's Slater, maybe, they can take people from Slater, set up their shelter, and absorb them. Sandbagging sounds easy. There's actually a right way and a wrong way to do sandbagging. And this is why we've got the coalition out there looking for organizations that want to be a part of making their community safer before a disaster or responding to a disaster.
Awesome, awesome. Can you... can you just give us a rough estimate about how many, because you said about 4 or 5 counties are in it right now?
Communities in Story County.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then are you looking to expand at this time, or are you just focusing on those specific communities and trying to get those ones trained?
I've just made initial contact with Eastern Story County with a church over near Ziering. We're just in the beginning stages that Mike's church went through, where I make the initial contact with the pastor or the leadership person, and they talk amongst the congregation. And if it seems like, as Keith calls it, a mission that they want to do, then they let me know, and we set up a training and go from there. So other than, we're just Story County is our focus. And Keith, I believe you've had some interest indicated from other emergency managers in other counties.
Many of my counterparts in these other counties also have that same dilemma, that the Red Cross, just due to their the resources they have, it's they're saying maybe upwards of 4 hours, and we need assistance right away. They're seeing what we're doing with our rats, and we're working through it. There are a lot of other things that folks don't think about. It's liability. The liability of opening up a shelter is quite high, and that's where partnering with the Red Cross, we can make it so that an organization that doesn't have a full-time tasking of doing this can do it in a way that's not going to jeopardize their organization. So it's one template of many things. If any organization were to come up to us and say that they want to be a part of the RATS, we would definitely not turn them away. But if they have any desire to help, helping out, picking up debris, maybe for somebody that is elderly and can't afford to have somebody come in, there's a whole bunch of different tasks that we have out there that we'd like to find folks. And, you know, Mike, what kind of discussions occurred within your organization when it came to adopting this as one of the things that you guys would do?
I actually wasn't part of that. Betty had contacted Vicki, who's the church secretary. At least that's who had contacted us. But once that was done, then she just reached out to members of the church asking for volunteers, and that's when I got involved with it at that point.
How did you respond in such a positive way? Why did you choose to do this?
Well, I grew up here in Ames, so I have a strong connection to this community, and I just realized that, you know, I need to start giving back to the community more. So I'm always looking for ways to help, and initially, this is not a very big time consumer. The training takes a little bit of time, but it's just a fact of being there. And I think we have a tendency to get complacent and get comfortable and not realize that the importance of the basics necessities like shelter. And when that gets taken away from somebody, how that can affect them. So, you know, I just want to be able to help in those situations.
Mm-hmm. I would like to just talk a little bit, Quan, if we have time, about the training. And we are aware that people lead very busy lives. And so, you know, there's lots of things out there to be trained on related to disasters. So we could have a training every month if we wanted to for the RATS teams. But just because of people's busy lives, we try to keep the training at minimum, just to give them enough information to help them do their jobs well. So that initial training is really only about 2.5 hours. And then we ask for an annual meeting of the RAT teams where they all come together. So that's what happened Saturday. They got to meet some other folks from the other teams or from the county. And then we did have a special education session on Saturday before the exercise. And Jason Hagland from Youth and Shelter Services has expertise in mental health in disasters. So he gave us about an hour, which again was too short, but just some basics on dealing with people in a shelter that may have mental health issues and discovering that it's not such a big deal after all. And not being concerned or worried about that. He helped us a lot in feeling more confident in opening a shelter. And then, so we look at some specific topics like that that might give the RAT members a little more confidence and reassurance when they open a shelter and how to do it well. So we have lots of topics in the future that we could cover and have for the RATS teams.
Can you explain to our viewers how they could possibly get involved, either a website or any contact information that could be out there for people to get involved with the RATS program?
Sure, they can contact Story County Emergency Management, and if you just Google that, we'll come up. We're on the Story County webpage as a department down there, or they can give our office a call at 515-382-7315. That'd get to my phone, and we'll get back to you and figure out what's best for your organization.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank all of you for coming in this morning and sharing information on the Rapid Actions Team for Sheltering. I want to thank you. It's a pleasure having you all on the radio. And we'll have more information on the website about this program and links to the program and numbers provided for you all in case you want to get involved. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk. I have been your host, Saquon Gatlin, and thank you for listening this morning. KHOI would like to thank all of today's guests and contributors for making this show possible. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Remember, you can also hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Also remember, KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. The Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun every Saturday, located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza. The Farmers Market brings fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment.